Greetings, this is Robert Noya, Editor-in-Chief of Sky and Telescope Magazine. I'm on the phone with Dr. Ellie Mayor, author of the feature article in the January 2012 issue, In the Footsteps of the First Recorded Transit of Venus. The article is based on Dr. Mayor's book, Venus in Transit, published by Princeton University Press in 2004. Dr. Mayor, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
You have been a professor in the history of mathematics, but obviously you are also very interested in astronomy. How and when did your interest in astronomy take root?
Well, I think it goes back to my earliest years. I must have been 5 or 6 years old. We lived in Tel Aviv in Israel. That's where I was born. And my grandmother, my grandfather had a great influence on me. And she used to take me at the end of Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath, when, according to tradition, when you can see three stars in the sky, then the Shabbat is over. And so she challenged me to find those three first stars. And I think that was my first introduction to astronomy.
And what inspired you to become interested in transits of Venus in particular?
Well, let's first of all talk for a minute about eclipses. So after I got interested in astronomy, I started to want to read books about astronomy. Now, in those days, like in the 1940s, in Israel it was awfully difficult to get foreign books. So I read all the Hebrew books I could find and always was intrigued by, inevitably, there was always a photograph of an eclipse and that black sun surrounded by the mysterious corona. That to me was like enchanting. And so when would I see a total eclipse? I looked at the list of eclipses. The closest one is in 2174 or something like that. So I knew if the eclipse doesn't come to me, I have to go to the eclipse. And the first total one was in Montana when we came to the United States on February 26, 1979. And we drove, I would say, 1,500 miles from where I was teaching at Eau Claire in Wisconsin in a blinding snowstorm. So we almost gave up. But then eclipse day dawned, perfectly clear, not a cloud. We saw it in perfect conditions.
How did that interest in eclipses morph into this interest in transits of Venus?
Well, in a way, transit is an eclipse, sort of. It's like a very small annular eclipse. But that's not the point. The point is, over the years, I collected a fairly large collection of old books on astronomy, going back sometimes to the 18th century. And especially the end of the 19th century, the eclipses of 1874 and 1882, every book mentioned that the next transit would be on June 8, 2004. So here I am looking at a book published 150 years ago, and already the exact date of the next transit was there, black and white. So that really intrigued me, and that piques your interest.
And you mentioned in your article that you traveled to Israel to see that June 2004 transit. Can you tell us a little bit more about that trip and what you saw?
We, as I mentioned in my article, we thought for a while to go to England, to Machhul, to that village where Jeremiah Horrocks first recorded the transit in 1639. But we thought, you know, England being England, the notorious English weather was a risk we couldn't take. And because I got so much involved or interested in the history of transit, I thought I wouldn't take that risk. So we traveled to Israel, to the southern part of Israel, to the Negev Desert, and watched it in perfect conditions from a cliff overlooking the huge Ramon Depression. So it was spectacular.
And what made you interested in visiting Machhul in England, this town where Jeremiah Horrocks witnessed the 1639 transit of Venus?
Well, you know, I read everything I could about the history of the transits, and that history is very dramatic, as you know, all these expeditions that went all to the end of the world, all the way around the globe, only to be clouded out on transit day. So that whole history kind of really swallowed me and became part of me. So I decided, well, why not go to England and go to that very first place where it was watched? I had already written Venus in Transit, the first edition, but then I thought, why not come up with an appendix and tell about my pilgrimage to Machhul? And so my wife and I went there in 2002.
And what was the town like? For example, are most of the buildings new or old? Did you find the townspeople to be particularly friendly?
Well, we didn't see any town people. It was like a typical American suburb. You don't see people. It's a very small village, and the houses we saw are relatively new. We simply took a bus from the closest relatively large town called Preston, a couple of miles, and left the bus somewhere in that village, and then wanted to make make our way to St. Michael's Church. That's where Horrocks was disrupted by an official church duty he had to fulfill, and when he came back to his room, the transit was already in progress. So we finally spotted the man walking his dog and stopped him and asked for directions. So he told us, well, just 2-3 minutes away from here walking. But what brought you to this place? He detected our foreign accent, so how come you came here? So we told him we are in the wake of an astronomical event that happened here 350 years ago. So he said, oh, you mean the transit of Venus, right? Apparently everyone in that town knows about that event.
In terms of the size of the town, I think it's maybe just a couple thousand people. Is it just maybe a couple miles across?
Yeah, it's like a small American suburb of a city, very rural, surrounded by low rolling hills and fields. It's very peaceful, very quiet, and very friendly. I mean, the few people we met were all very friendly.
And now putting it in its historical context, I mean, obviously, this was the first time in history when a human being actually saw a transit of Venus knowing exactly what he was seeing. Would you say that this was a very significant event in the history of astronomy and also the fact that Horrocks predicted this event?
Yes, absolutely. Well, for a variety of reasons. First of all, as you know, Johannes Kepler, in his last major work, the Rudolphine Tables, predicted a couple of transits of Venus, and the next one he predicted was to be in 1761. And then comes a young, unknown Jeremiah Horrocks, who was basically self-taught. He spent 2 years at Cambridge, but was interested in astronomy and was basically taught himself, and re-examined some other almanacs and found that Kepler actually missed a transit of Venus coming up the year after, namely in 1639. And so he became all very excited and wrote to his few friends and asked them to watch that event with all the care they could. But as far as we know, only he and his friend William Crabtree actually saw the transit. Now, you have to remember, it was December in England, very short days. The sun set already at 3:30 p.m. or so. So he just saw the very beginning of the transit, and after half an hour, the sunset. There was also another thing. By confirming that a transit would occur in 1639, that was for him a big test to see if the existing almanac are accurate, because in those days, or, you know, you didn't have computers, so all the calculations were done by hand. And here was a God-given opportunity to confirm an event that was totally predicted, totally on a mathematical basis. So it was perhaps one of the very first astronomical phenomena predicted mathematically and then confirmed by actual observations. It was a big event.
One thing that really strikes me and saddens me as I read the article is the unfortunate fact that Jeremiah Horrocks, after making this very significant contribution to astronomy, died just a few years later at the age of 22. And it makes me wonder, if he had lived longer, do you think he would have gone on to make additional major contributions to astronomy?
Yes, I think even Newton mentioned that, I think, that had he lived longer, he would have made a major contribution. Let me just double-check that. I think Newton said it, or if not Newton, some contemporary. That was really a tragedy. It reminds me of Mozart, but Mozart lived a long life compared to Jeremiah Horrocks. Mozart lived 35 years, so it's unfortunate, very unfortunate.
And it's interesting, of course, because back then, you know, astronomers didn't know the scale of the solar system. There was a lot that we know today that they didn't know back then, and yet they were still able to make these very successful predictions and make new discoveries.
And one more comment about his friend Crabtree, who watched from Manchester. And there is a moving story that the skies were all clouded up, but for a few short minutes there was a break in the clouds and he saw the black silhouette of Venus on the sun. But he was so overcome by emotions, for a few minutes he just stood there still, unable to act, unable to move, and finally brought back to his senses and made a few quick drawings. And those were the only observations, his and Horrocks's, of that event. The only observations we are aware of.
Obviously, we have another transit coming up just a few months from now in June, and this will be the last opportunity that almost everybody alive in the world today will have to see a Venus transit in their lifetime. I'm going to be in Hawaii. What are your plans for the June 2012 transit?
Well, We have been invited by a good friend of ours in Arizona to watch it from there, even though there I think you will only be able to see the first half of the transit, the ingress and progress of Venus over the Sun, but not the egress. So having seen the one in 2004, we decided we can live with that.
And I also understand, and you mentioned earlier, that you're an eclipse chaser. And I should let our listeners know that you and I met in person last summer during a trip to the South Pacific to see a total solar eclipse from Easter Island, which I know for both of us was an unforgettable experience. What are some of your other exciting eclipse experiences?
Well, every eclipse is exciting, and every eclipse is great, and every eclipse is unique. And it is, because there are so many different durations, and each eclipse is different, and the location and the people you meet. So once in Montana, we watched it from a stadium next to a small village called Wolf Point, and everything was snowed out, but the skies were perfectly clear, and there was a highway just a couple of hundred yards from us, and what amazed me, there were trucks going by during totality and not even stopping to see what's happening. I mean, it was just mind-boggling. Also, at the exact moment of second contact, when totality began, the town's sirens started to go off to add to the excitement, so it was interesting.
And what other countries have you visited over the years to see total eclipses?
Well, the one black mark on my calendar is Hawaii, 1991. That was one of the longest eclipses of the 20th century, and everyone was going to either Baja California or Hawaii. We decided to go to Hawaii because we said Hawaii is interesting by itself, and we paid dearly for that because on eclipse day it was all clouded up. Hawaii, of all places, were promised 360 days of sunshine per year, well, we got one of the remaining five.
Oh, gosh. Well, that happens.
The leader of that trip was the late Ken Wilcox. He was the president of the Astronomical League for many years. And you could not talk to him for 2 days. He was just beside himself with grief. It was a big disappointment. But then we were compensated. The next one was in November 1994 in Bolivia. And that was among the most spectacular ones I saw because we saw it from high from the Altiplano plain in the Andes. It was spectacular. Now, don't get me wrong, I also had my disappointments. Hawaii, I told you about that. And then we again were clouded, snowed out in Mongolia in 1997. We went all the way by train to the Siberian border, only to be snowed out on eclipse day. And then again in 1991, the European eclipse, we were in Austria and had to make a choice. Do we go to Salzburg or to Munich? We were about midway. And just basically by a flip of coin, we went to Munich and were rained out. During totality, it was pouring. So I have not the greatest track record. I went to about 15 eclipse expeditions and saw only about 10 or so, including annulars. I have a friend who only saw one single eclipse, and he saw it, so he has a much better track record. He has 100% success. But one myth I have to debunk. In almost every book you read about the total silence during totality, where everything comes to a standstill, that is nonsense. Everyone cheers and yells, wow, wow, my God. I mean, there's a whole chorus of yellings and anything but quiet, including that siren or whine in Wolf Point during totality, and also the eclipse of 2005 in the Pacific. Our captain decided that the moment of totality, he has to blow the ship's horn, and it was deafening. And we had only 29 seconds of it was a hybrid, so it was a very short eclipse. 29 seconds of it, the ship's horn blew to let the whole world know that we have been successful.
That answers the questions I had. Was there anything else you'd like to mention before we sign off?
Well, I've been a loyal reader of your magazine since the late 1950s, and my article on the fireball I saw in Israel appeared in the July 1963 issue with the photo of it on the front cover, so I'm very proud of it. A copy of that magazine hangs in my study, framed, so you are always in my thoughts. It's a wonderful magazine, wonderful.
Thank you very much, and I should let our readers know that in the near future we're going to be running another article by Dr. Mayor about the 1769 Venus transit, and we're really looking forward to having that appear in the magazine as well.
Thank you, Bob. My pleasure. I'm always looking forward to get the next edition of Sky Telescope.